Okay, so in the Wheel of Sharp Weapons, it has an introduction and then quite a long first piece, then another brief interlude, and then a second chunk, and then like a concluding part. So Thursday I focused on the first chunk, the big chunk, and this time I'm going to focus on the second one. The first one centered mostly around if we're experiencing certain situations now, what did we do in previous lives or maybe even earlier in this life to create the karmic cause for our experiences? And so that those verses make us, they help us to understand why we experience what we experience. Yeah, because so often, well, as I was saying on Thursday, when bad things happen, we say, what did I do to deserve this? Although we never say that when good things happen. But at least when bad things happen, you know, Dharma Rakshita, who's the author of the poem, tells us the kinds of things that we did in the past that created the karmic cause. And I find that very helpful, because if I'm experiencing an unpleasant result and I know the type of action, it's not necessarily to know exactly what lifetime and all the details of the action, but just the type of action, then that gives me some ability to at least stop creating those same kind of causes again in this life. And it also helps to stop blaming other people and the rest of the world for our problems, which we like to do a lot. It's so much easier than being responsible. You know, when we can blame people, let's just blame them. Yeah. And we think that will make us happy. Yeah. I didn't do anything wrong. The world's mean to me. But, you know, that really actually doesn't make us happy. It puts us in a prison of our own making. Because if our problems are due to what other people do, yeah, then how are we ever going to control other people and make them do what we want them to do? Yeah. If you'll excuse me for talking about politics. But you see this very much in the Trump campaign, don't you? What are America's problems due to? They're due to these people and these people and these people and these people. And if we just get rid of all of those people, you know, build a nice little, not nice, big wall, you know, then all of our problems will be gone. And, you know, someone will make us all act the way Big Daddy wants us to act. Okay. Now, when is that going to happen, that we're going to be able to control the external world and make everybody do and be what we want them to do and be? When's that going to happen?
Never.
You're right. Never. Yeah. Because each of us, since the time we've been born, we've been trying to control everybody around us, giving them all of our stupendous advice about how they should change and what they should do. And they don't do it. Can you imagine? You know? Our sages' advice, and they don't do it. Yeah? Try raising kids. Oh boy, do they do what you want them to do? Maybe when they're little, wait until they're a teenager. Okay? And so my mother used to have a slogan. I've sometimes thought I should write a book called Sayings from My Mother. She wasn't a Buddhist, but many of the things she said can be interpreted in a Buddhist way. She used to say, Don't knock your head against the wall. Okay, anybody else's mother have that little gem of wisdom? Yeah, as if we're all going around knocking our head against the wall. But what but what she meant was, you know, if you knock your head against the wall, what's going to happen? Is the wall going to move? No. Yeah. Your head's going to hurt. So if we try and go around and change the rest of the world to be what we want it to be and force it to be what we want it to be, we're going to have a really big headache because the world is not going to do that. And so this is, I think, the real beauty of the Buddha's teachings, because either we could try and change the world, knocking our head against the wall. Maybe that's what dear Donald's going to spend his time doing. I don't know. But, or we can change ourselves. Okay? Shantideva in the Bodhisattva's, engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds, he was saying that either you can, well, his thing was you can either put on shoes or you can try and asphalt the whole world. He didn't say asphalt, he said put leather. But, you know, we're modern people, we asphalt everything. Yeah, so we could either asphalt the world or we can put on a pair of shoes. So we could either try and change everybody else or we can work on ourselves. We can't control anybody else. The only one we have any ability to deal with is our own mind. Yeah. And so I think this is the beauty of the Buddha's teaching, is that he says you have power and you have ability, and it has to start in here by transforming what's in here. But you can do it, and the Buddha himself did it and told us the tools that he used to do it. Okay? So the first part of the book is getting us going in that, you know, if you did this, if you're experiencing this, this is what you did, so do something different now. And gave us some advice about what to practice instead and what to abandon. Okay. Then the second, so that first part of the book was a lot about karma in that respect. The second part of the book is talking about things we do now that are going to be, that lie behind a lot of our behavior. Well, things we do now and the kind of self-centered thoughts that lie behind that behavior. And so what this section of the book helps us think about is what kind of causes are we creating for what kind of future in future lives, okay? So it's very interesting. And Dharma Rakshita, I love the way he writes. It's like Shantideva. He just tells it like it is, and he doesn't sugarcoat anything. And for a stubborn mind like mine, I find that very effective. Yeah. So I'm just going to pick out some verses and read them to you. All the verses have a refrain, so I'll explain that when we come to it. Okay, so let's just open up and see. Okay. Okay, here's a good one. Though my wish for happiness is great, I do not gather its causes. Though I have little endurance for pain, I am rife with the dark craving of greed. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self. Okay, so the first two lines, though my wish for happiness is great. Yeah, can you resonate with that? We all want happiness every single moment of the day. Okay. But do we create the causes? Yeah. What's the cause of a good rebirth? What's the cause of a good rebirth?
No attachment.
Wisdom and bodhicitta.
No, specifically the cause of a good rebirth. When you study precious human life, what's the cause of a good rebirth?
Journey, morality.
Morality. Okay, ethical conduct. Yeah. Do we keep good ethical conduct? Do we abandon the 10 non-virtues? Or do we kind of abandon them when it's convenient, but when we have something to gain, do we renegotiate? Yeah. So many of you have probably taken the precept to abandon lying. Yeah, it sounds good, doesn't it? But I'm going to abandon lying. I'm not going to lie anymore. Yeah. But, we always have this thing. Yes, but when there's something I can gain from just redesigning the truth a little bit, then why not do it? Yeah, we think that way, don't we? Yeah. Few people are nodding their heads. Few of you are looking like me. But we do, don't we? Yeah. We say, oh, yes. Talking behind people's back is really negative, especially when other people do it about us. Very negative, creating disharmony, talking badly about us behind our back. But when we don't like somebody, you know, like in your office, what do you do?
Talk behind their back.
Yeah, we talk behind their back. And we talk to all of our friends, and we tell them what this person over here did, so that all of our friends are on our side, and we form a nice little group that trashes that person. And we make sure the boss knows that we're the faithful, good workers, and that person, who just happens to be up for the same promotion that we would like to have, is not a very good worker. That we're better. We do that, don't we? Okay. So, though my wish for happiness is great, I do not gather its causes. Though I have little endurance for pain, do you have little endurance for pain? Yeah. No endurance. I want happiness all the time. I should have happiness all the time. Why? Because I'm me. Yeah, I shouldn't have any pain. So I have little endurance for pain. Yeah, but I'm rife with the dark craving of greed. So no endurance to work hard and be honest, but I am greedy and craving for what I want. And I will manipulate and do whatever I can get to do whatever I can do to get what I want without experiencing any pain at all. True? Not true. Some of you are looking like you want to throw a tomato at me. I'm just reading the book. And then the refrain, dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. That's talking about, okay, why do we act like this? Why do we want happiness but not create the causes? Why do we not want any pain or any convenience, but we're always craving and greedy? Why? Yeah, because we grasp at an idea of ourself that is completely erroneous. Okay, we think that there's a real person here, and we feel like we're real people, don't we? I'm here. I'm me, sitting here. Yeah, independent, person. I'm not existing dependent on anything else. I'm just here. Yeah. But then think about it. We only exist because the causes for us exist. Do you feel like you only exist because the causes for you exist? Yeah. Have you ever thought about that? That I exist because there were causes for me? Did that ever enter your mind? It never entered my mind. There's just this feeling of I'm here. What are you talking about, causes? I'm here. And yet, when we look, we only exist because of the causes. We don't exist independent of the causes. Okay? Think about it. Try saying to yourself on a daily basis, I exist only because the causes for me exist. See if that sits well in your heart. Or if something inside of you says, forget causes, I'm here. Okay? So that feeling of like there's a real concrete me who's here, yeah, that is a misapprehension of the actual self. It's reifying, concretizing the self, the I, making it something that's independent, when in fact, who we are is very dependent on all sorts of other factors. Yeah, our body's dependent on the sperm and egg of mom and dad and all the tofu and broccoli you ever ate. You know, plus some grapes maybe, and you know, who knows what else you eat. Okay. Our mind exists because each moment of mind produces a new moment of mind. Why do we think what we think? Because of habitual ways of thinking from the past. Yeah. But we feel like we're some kind of independent person, but we aren't. Okay, so when he says, dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Talking about that false conception of who we are. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self. So he's not talking about killing ourselves here. It's not that the self is a butcher and enemy. When he's saying the self, there he's talking about the self-centeredness. Okay, so we have two things. We have the self-grasping, which is the one that fabricates this independent self. And then there's the self-centeredness that says, my happiness is most important. My suffering hurts more than anybody else's. So these two are really good buddies. Yeah, they help each other. They collaborate to make us quite miserable. But both of them pretend to be our friend, especially the self-centered thought. Yeah, the self-centered thought says, it says to us, it's like a little voice, I'm looking out for your welfare. Follow me, do what I say. Yeah, because I'm going to look out for you better than anybody else will look out for you. Okay, so then, you know, self-centeredness says something. We salute. We do our three prostrations to our self-centered mind. And self-centered mind says, tell that person off. And we tell them off. And self-centered mind says, feel sorry for yourself because the world is mean to you. And we do that. And self-centered thought says, you know, slug somebody in the face. We do it. Okay? So in following the self-centered thought and the self-grasping ignorance, we're creating a lot of negativity, a lot of this destructive karma that then ripens in our own misery. Okay, so here, instead of doing that process again and again, He says, dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self. Okay, I like that expression, dance and trample on the head of this betrayer. You know, it's like when you finally figure out what it is that's been causing us harm all this time, then we dance on its head. Yeah, and trample it. And it's what we're trampling, what we're dancing on, is not any human being, because, or any other living being, because they are not the source of our misery. The source of our misery is inside here, the self-centered attitude, the self-grasping ignorance. Okay? So it's kind of fun. There's different practices like chö, which means cutting, where you visualize spirits and, you know, transforming, cutting up your body and transforming it into blissful wisdom nectar and offering it to the spirits. But for the spirits, when I do this kind of practice, for spirits, I don't think of external beings who are spirits. I think of my own selfishness. Yeah, my own self-pity, my own greed, my own anger. And so it's really kind of fun to do these meditations, because you take the aspects of yourself that are actually creating the negative karma and harming you, and you anthropomorphize them. You make them look like something. Okay? And then you imagine your body becoming blissful wisdom nectar that you offer to those spirits or those parts of you, yeah, that are harmful. And you imagine them being satisfied, yeah, and content. So, for example, I love to feel sorry for myself. Yeah. One of the inmates I write to, he coined the expression pity party. I love to have a pity party. Things don't go my way. I feel sad, sorry for myself. I try so hard. I do so many good things. People don't appreciate me. They don't love me enough. They don't see how kind I am in everything I do. Oh, I'm so lonely. I'm so unloved. And so I have a little pity party. Okay? And if one of my friends, you know, I'm kind of dramatic about it. My parents used to call me Sarah Bernhardt. So, you know, oh, I feel so miserable. And then, you know, wanting some friend to come and say, like, oh, children, what's wrong? You know, you seem really unhappy. So that's what I want. So somebody, I'm acting like this. So somebody comes and says, children, what's wrong? You look unhappy. And I go, nothing. Yeah. Okay. So I have this down really well. Okay, if you ever need a pity party, call me. You know, it comes complete with lead balloons and infinite boxes of Kleenex. Okay? So when I do this, I imagine the part of me that likes the pity party. Okay? So she's just a little head. Okay, with a lace collar all around her, you know, kind of like Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth I, you know, they always had this big lacy collar around them. Yeah, so she's there with her big lacy collar. You can't see her body because she's, you know, half in a quagmire, and just her head and her big lacy collar there, with big eyes. Yeah. And so that's how I imagine that part of me. And then I take, you know, this bowl full of the blissful wisdom nectar, which was my body, and I imagine, you know, offering some of it to her. You have to spoon feed her, you know, because she's just a little girl. You know, and you offer that, and then she, you know, I imagine she feels, oh, somebody understands me. Oh, maybe I'm okay. Whatever she needs, I imagine that she has that. And then she recovers, and she's satisfied, and she disappears. Okay? So that's how I do these kind of meditations where you're offering to the spirits. I find it quite helpful to anthropomorphize them. Yeah. I also have a temper. I get angry. Yeah. So sometimes I anthropomorphize my anger too. Yeah. Big, this big head, you know. You know. Yeah. Just ready to go at anybody who happens to say hello to me. Yeah, ready to attack. And then similarly, you know, make an offering to my own anger, whatever it is, you know, when I'm angry, whatever it is that I'm needing, some understanding, some communication, then I imagine offering to that and, you know, it's satisfied. So, you know, you dance and you trample like that, and you make an offering. So it's actually quite a skillful way, because we're always projecting things outside anyway. You know, we project all sorts of things on other people. So here, we're just, you know, projecting outside those parts of ourself that cause us problems, and we make offerings, we satisfy them, we dance and trample on them. Okay? So I think it's very skillful psychology, actually. Yeah. Should we do another verse? Oh, how about this? Oh, this is a good one. Though I want immediate results, my efforts to achieve them are feeble. Though I pursue many tasks, I never complete a single one. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self. Okay. Though I want immediate results. We all want immediate results, right? In our Dharma practice, certainly. We want immediate results. At least we should attain the path of seeing by next Tuesday. Yeah. You know, and Buddhahood by Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's on my list to get enlightened, so I want to get through my list. And let's just do it quickly, get this enlightened business sorted out, accomplish it, and then I can go on with the next thing on my list.
Yeah.
Okay? So we want immediate results. Yeah, I mean, my goodness, I've been meditating for 2 days. I should already have a vision of Chenrezig. Yeah, I should already, you know, be experiencing bliss and emptiness. Yeah, after 2 days, definitely. You know. So I want immediate results in our Dharma practice. Also in your career, do you want immediate results? Yeah, do you want your boss to notice how good you are after you've been working there for a week and offer you a promotion? So then after you're promoted, you get the wonderful opportunity to work 16-hour days. Yeah, that's the benefit of getting a promotion, isn't it? Yeah. So, though I want immediate results, my efforts to achieve them are feeble. Yeah? We're impatient. Yeah, we feel like the world owes us something, that things should be quick, cheap, and easy, especially for us, that I shouldn't have to make any effort. Yeah, because I'm so good anyway, and I make so much effort anyway. So things just should come to me. Hmm? Right? We want immediate results, and our efforts are feeble. You kind of have to laugh at yourself, don't you, when you read these verses? I mean, either we cry or we laugh, so we might as well laugh. Yeah, but it's true. You know, though I pursue many tasks, we are very busy. You need a volunteer, I'll do it. I'll do this, I'll do that. I volunteer for this, I volunteer for that. I'll drive here, I'll go there, I'll do this. You know, volunteer many tasks. Do any of them get done? Maybe. You know, when you live in a monastery or a Buddhist center, yeah, you work with volunteers a lot. And people mean really well. You know, they hear something needs to be done. They really mean well. But they don't check whether they have the time and the ability and everything to do it. And they volunteer. And then you're so happy, oh, all these volunteers. And then you're waiting for things to happen. And time is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And nothing's happening. You know? And dare you call that person and ask them, you know? So maybe you kind of get up your nerve, you call them, oh, you volunteered to do this, how's it going, do you need any help? Oh, I'm really sorry, I'm so busy. I know I should have called you to tell you I couldn't do it, but I didn't. And then you're left standing there, having counted on somebody, and it, you know, what you thought they were going to do, it not getting done. Yeah. So we're like that, aren't we? We pursue many tasks, but very few of them get done. Yeah. We have a very long list, don't we? Especially on, you know, what you're going to do around the house, all the things you're going to fix that they have been piling up around the house. And okay, this Saturday, I'm really going to, you know, go fix all those things. But Saturday comes, and, you know, you're tired. So, sleep, watch a ball game, go swimming, go out to eat, sleep some more. And, you know, next Saturday will come, we'll do them then. So, you know, he's pointing out our faults. Yeah, can you imagine that? Dhammarakshita is pointing out our faults. Isn't that rude? Yeah, when other people point out our faults, we say they're so rude. Yeah. But is he being rude? Is he trying to hurt our feelings and make us feel bad? No, he's pointing these things out of compassion. Yeah, because we need our faults pointed out so that we can start to rectify them. If they don't get pointed out, then we just continue on the same way. And if we continue on the same way, who suffers from our behavior? We're the principal one who suffers from our behavior. Okay, we may inconvenience other people, but we're the ones that create the negative karma and have to experience the unfortunate rebirth, not other people. So it's out of compassion that Dharmarakshita is pointing these things out to us, because he's giving us a chance to really look inside and figure out how we want to change. So we really should feel grateful to him. Usually we feel grateful to the people who praise us and appreciate us, don't we? Yeah? Those are the people we love. I mean, you don't love somebody who picks on you. We love people who praise us. Huh? And the more they praise us, the more we love them. And they can be manipulating us and deceiving us, but we don't care because we're suckers for praise. Yeah? If you praise me, I'll do anything. Even the other person has a harmful motivation, we'll just follow them. But somebody who's a really good friend who points out our mistakes to us, we get mad at them because they're not supposed to see our mistakes. And if they do see them and they need to point them out to us, they should at least make 3 prostrations and kneel down and ask us permission to reveal their mistake, our mistake. Yeah, but they don't do that. They really should, don't you think? Yeah. It'd be so much nicer if your husband and wife made 3 prostrations and then kneeled down and said, "Dear, please take out the garbage." Yeah. That would go over a lot better, huh? Yeah. "Please take out the garbage. It's been 3 weeks already." Okay. Oh, okay. "Though I am eager to make new friends." Yeah, you got that? "Though I'm eager to make new friends, my loyalty and friendships are short-lived. Though I aspire for resources, I seek them through theft and extortion. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self." Okay, so what do? We're eager to make new friends. We want to be Mr. or Ms. Popular. Okay, we're eager to make new friends, but our loyalty and friendships are short-lived. We befriend somebody, they stop amusing us, we forget them. Okay? We befriend somebody, especially because we think they know somebody who's really important and they can introduce us to that person. And then it winds up they don't know that important person after all. Forget them. Okay? We, make commitments to people. But when they displease us, we renegotiate. Yeah. We have Dharma teachers, and we, say, "You're my guru, you're my teacher, I will do everything for you." Except what they ask us to, because it's inconvenient and it presses our buttons. Okay. So we pledge our loyalty to other people, but our loyalty is very short-lived. Yeah, we pledge our friendship, but we don't really care. Yeah, when we can get something out of somebody, we're real chummy with them. When we can't get something out of them, goodbye. Yeah. For me, it was amazing watching the Republican convention. Did it seem like that's what people were doing there? I mean, how they were speaking and what they were saying, They were saying things so that other people will give them the jobs they want or they'll get something from all these people. Okay. So we have another convention starting tomorrow. Doesn't the Democratic one start tomorrow? Yeah, so let's see how that one goes. Yeah, but, it's just like amazing watching these people. Talk about phony baloney. But they all look so sparkling.
It's honest to think the Democrats are doing that too.
You think the Democrats are doing that? I wonder. We'll check it out. I don't know. I think Donald has some very unique abilities. Yeah? Doesn't he? I mean, who else could get away with proposing to build a wall around the country? Yeah? No one else could get away with saying that.
The Chinese emperor.
Huh?
The Chinese emperor.
Yeah, the Chinese emperor, right. Now we know who he was in his past life.
Yeah. Or Hitler.
Yeah.
And of course, it hasn't done his geographical homework, where there are rivers at some point, and there are riparian rights, and you cannot build walls.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Yes, but that doesn't matter. Yeah. So it's, I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody who loves Dear Donald. Yeah, people tell me I shouldn't talk about politics and Dharma talks, but it's such a good example, isn't it? I think it's such a good example. How could you come up with a better example? I mean, Chris Christie, talk about this, you know? Though I am eager to make new friends, my loyalty and friendships are short-lived. I mean, what was Chris Christie doing? Anyway, I would love to teach these people the Dharma. I would love it. You know, when I do prostrations to the Buddha, they usually say, have your mother on one side, your father on the other side, and all sentient beings around you, and then your enemies in front of you, and, you know, I have Hillary here, I have Donald here, I have the U.S. Congress in front of me. And we're all bowing to the Buddha together. The U.S. Congress is actually doing something instead of sitting there. You know? And I mean, this is the way I deal with it. I include them all in my visualizations. And, you know, yeah, there is, what's his name? There's Paul Ryan bowing to the Buddha, and Mitch O'Connell, he's bowing to the Buddha. I mean, you can't get much better than that, can you? Yeah, I just include them all in my visualization, and that's how, you know, that's how we do it.
You had some success. I mean, there was a filibuster about gun control. I mean, there was a try on that. I mean, it's like some people are feeling it.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get some gun control legislation, you know. Yeah. Make it easier on the police. Yeah. Everybody's sticking up for the police, but they have a hard job. Why? Because the citizenry is armed. I will avoid getting on my soapbox. Okay. Though I aspire for resources, we all aspire for resources, don't we? Yeah. Money, wealth, possessions. I seek them through theft and extortion. So we want stuff, but are we willing to work hard to get it? Are we willing to be responsible? No, let's just steal a little bit or extort a little bit or cook the books. Yeah, why not cook the books, get something out of it? Okay, we aspire for resources. Do we create the karmic cause for resources? What's the karmic cause to have wealth?
Generosity.
Are we generous? A little bit. I went to the supermarket and I have 37 cents leftover change, and I'll put it in the little thing. Yeah? But we're most generous to ourselves, aren't we? Oh, listen to this one. You think he's going to let up. He doesn't. Though skilled at flattery and innuendo, my discontent runs deep. Though assiduously amassing wealth, I am chained by miserliness. Okay, what's the fault of this? Who do we blame? The self-grasping egoism, self-grasping ignorance, the self-centered thought. So dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self. Okay. So skilled at flattery and innuendo, Are you good at that? Are you good at flattering people and hinting so that you can get what you want? Mm-hmm. We're good at it. Yeah? Yeah. I remember as a kid, I was taught it's impolite to ask somebody directly for something. Better hint, flatter. Yeah, then they'll give it to you and they'll feel good about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So have a rotten motivation that wants to manipulate people to get your resources. Become skilled at flattery and hinting and innuendo. And our discontent runs deep. So we succeed in getting what we want, but we're never satisfied. We're always discontent. More and better, more and better. That's our mantra. Yeah, I want more and better. Excuse my voice. Yeah, we all want more and better. Hmm? Huh? The water's for me? Thank you. It's only water. I don't deserve something better. After all, I'm me. Oh, I'm sorry. I should be flat. Prashant, you are so wonderful. You are such a good host. I really appreciate everything you do. And I'm really... Yeah, my innuendo isn't too good. I should be more discreet, right? My discontent runs deep. Okay, second line. Though assiduously amassing wealth. Yeah, he offered me some chocolate earlier. I took 4 pieces of chocolate. I only needed to eat 1. I took 4. The rest are in my bag ready to go. And I'm sure they'll melt on the way home and make a mess. And then I'll go, oh, why was I so greedy?
You'll blame
Prashant. Huh? I'll blame him. Yeah, you offered too much chocolate. You should only offer me 1 piece. See, you can't do anything right. Actually, it was your wife who did that.
No, yeah.
She did not do the 3 prostrations.
But she's practicing generosity. Though assiduously amassing wealth, I am chained by miserliness. Yeah, so we assiduously amass wealth, you know. Not just 4 pieces of chocolate, but, you know, like, let's get as much as we can. And yet, you know, are we generous? No, we save our stuff. Yeah. Sometimes, there's this beautiful verse. I'm teaching Nagarjuna's Precious Garland on Thursday nights. And we just had a verse where he's the whole text is directed towards this king, okay? And so he's telling the king, look, you're going to die sometime, and you have this whole storehouse full of goods, and you should use it to create merit now, because on your deathbed, even if you've told your ministers to give your wealth away when you're dying, they're not going to do it. They're going to keep it because they want to ingratiate themselves with the new king. Okay? So, in other words, you may have left a will, but don't count on the people, your executor, distributing it as you want. Be generous now. And he's saying, otherwise, you either, he was saying, you know, you can spend something now and you have some enjoyment now. You can spend something or give something away and then it comes back to you as wealth in future lives. But at least that way, you're doing something with it. But if you just sit and save it and hoard it, yeah, then you don't have the happiness of this life or the happiness of future lives. Okay. So he's not telling the king to go and get in credit card debt and spend money that you don't have. Yeah. But he's telling the king, don't hoard stuff. Okay. So but do we hoard stuff? Yeah.
We're masters.
We're masters. Yes. The master of hoarding. Yeah. We collect all sorts of things. Yeah. Our drawers are full. Our cupboards are full. Our closets are full. Our garage is overflowing. We even have a storage unit. And we can't give anything away. Because if we give it away, we might need it sometime. Okay? So I don't know if any of you are like me, but I save all sorts of little containers because you always need a little container for something, don't you? And if I threw them out, then, or, you know, because that's what other people tell me to do is throw them out, then I'm sure I would need them the next day and I wouldn't have, you know, like the little pouches, you know, or little containers. Anybody else save them? You know? Yeah, you save them. Good. You understand me. Okay, you save them too? Yeah, good. Okay. I stayed at somebody's house some years ago. She didn't save the little containers like me. She saved big cardboard boxes. Yeah, she wasn't going to move for a while. But, you know, you always can have a basement full of cardboard boxes because you might need them. And if you give them away or recycle them, then for sure you're going to need all of them the very next day. So this is just talking about little containers and cardboard boxes that we cannot bear to part with. Okay. What about some other things that we can't bear to part with? You know, we're so miserly. Hmm? Yeah.
Venerable, what about things like the depression mentality? If our parents or grandparents, they suffered with sincere loss.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that was practical. I remember going to my great aunt's home and zillions of tin foil pie plates and jars because these things were not available. And she wasn't being a hoarder. It was just a leftover from that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in her consciousness, being responsible. That's, I guess, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay. There's a difference between saving a few things because you might need them and saving a lot of things because your mind is afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So it's the mind that is fearful and keeps things, you know, is miserly out of fear, even when there's no longer a cause for that kind of fear. And even when, you know, if we really believe in karma and that generosity is the cause of wealth, then even when there's a shortage of things, you share. And my experience living in India is that the people who were the poorest were often very generous. Yeah, I remember one time, you may remember this, there was one old nun who lived on the hill down between Dharamsala and the library. She lived with her sister in a little hut that was made out of ghee cans, you know, that were cut up. The walls were ghee and the, you know, roof, I think, something similar, earthen floor. And I remember they invited me for tea one day, And they, you know, they cook tea on their kerosene stove and served me some tea and then took out kopsay, which is the Tibetan version of donuts, maybe? I don't know. Kopsay is fried, some kind of fried bread. But they're a real delicacy, you know? And they had been saving them. And, you know, here was I just came, you know, they invited me for tea and they're giving me kopsay and they're giving me this and giving me that. And they're dirt poor. Yeah. And me, I mean, I was really poor when I lived in India, but I did have a little bit more money than they did. And it was extremely hard for me to give even 25 pesa, the cost of a cup of tea, to a beggar when I walked to the market. Yeah.
When I was at the nunnery, just starting, you offered some of your clothes to the nunnery, and they were all patched. And the nun came to me and said, "Wow, maybe we need to help her."
I don't throw anything out. I lived in India so long. I mean, even now, you know, I mean, I wear things until really they are ragged. And, yeah. My mother would not be happy. Okay. Okay, though assiduously amassing wealth, I am chained by miserliness. And miserliness is like a chain. It's so confining. It's like you have this impulse to give, and then another thought in your mind says, no. Though rarely rendering help to others, I remain most boastful. Though unwilling to take risks, I am bloated with ambition. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self. Okay, so more of self-centeredness's antics. Though rarely rendering help to others, because, you know, we're very busy people. We don't have time to help others. You know, because we spend time, we meditate, taking and giving meditation, transform our body, radiate out, become whatever anybody else needs. We are full of good wishes. But when people ask us for help, we're busy that day. Yeah, we're really busy. I'm really sorry. Any other day I could do it, but this day that you asked me, really, I'm, you know, just full from morning till evening. Yeah, but though rarely rendering help to others, I remain most boastful. But, you know, I really help a lot of people. Yeah? I give donations. Yeah? Just like Donald gives donations to the veterans group. Yeah? Remember? Yeah? I give lots of donations. I do lots of things. I'm really helping so many people. Really, that's the aim in my life. I love helping people. But I'm so sorry you asked me today, and I'm really very busy today. What am I doing? But I boast. I'm very good at boasting. Though unwilling to take risks, I am bloated with ambition. Bloated with ambition, does that give you a caricature, like I was talking about, of your ambition, your bloated ambition to offer to some big, fat, like rhinoceros or something, bloated with ambition? Huh?
With a cigar.
With a cigar, yes. A rhinoceros with a cigar. Bloated with ambition, but I'm unwilling to take risks. In fact, forget risks. I'm unwilling to do anything. But I'm very ambitious. I have lots of plans. Let me tell you my plans. You know, you should really invest in my business. I have so many plans. I'm going to do this wonderful thing. Yeah, invest now. Special deal for you. $29.99. Yeah, you'll make a fortune.
Atlantic City casinos.
We are bloated with ambition. Okay, so self-centeredness, self-grasping. Though I have had many teachers, my capacity to observe precepts remains weak. Though I have many students, my patience and wish to help are scant. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, an enemy, the self. So here we're getting into some dicey territory. Though I have many teachers, so it's talking about Dharma teachers here. We have many teachers, right? Yeah, we all go when His Holiness comes. Some of you were Geshe Gelson's teachers, students, you know. We're students of many, many teachers. Yeah, we go to tantric initiations. We, you know, say I'm going to keep my daily commitments. I'm going to do succession guru yoga. I'm going to observe the pledges of the five Dhyani Buddhas. I'm going to keep the tantric precepts. I'm keeping the bodhisattva vows. Even we took refuge. We have the five lay precepts. You know, we've promised all these things. And my capacity to observe precepts remains weak. We have many teachers, we've made many promises, but I mean, even start with the five precepts, which are the easiest ones to keep. I mean, bodhisattva and tantric precepts are much more difficult. Five lay precepts: don't kill, don't steal, don't have unwise and unkind sexual behavior, don't lie, don't take intoxicants. We promise these many times to many teachers. Then you're at a party. They're serving some intoxicants. Your friends want you to have a drink or a smoke or whatever it is, their intoxicant of choice. And, you know, you don't want to seem like an oddball, especially because you're a Buddhist. And if you're the only one at the party who's not drinking and everybody knows that you're a Buddhist, it looks really bad for Buddhism. Because it looks like you're being a prude. Yeah, you're being a prude. Sorry, I'm a Buddhist. I'm not drinking. What kind of person are you? Yeah. So, you know, we don't want other people to think badly of Buddhism, do we? You know, we don't want that. So really, for the sake of the Dharma, so that these people will think well of Buddhism, then we should have a drink. Yeah. Actually, yesterday I got an email from, well, he says he's my student. I should take this email out and read it to you. It's classic. You know, he was somebody who was incarcerated for a while. He has mental problems, quite definitely. He was incarcerated. He got out. He's been in and out for a while. But he got a job as a bartender. And he told me about, he has such a good opportunity now to share Buddha's wisdom and compassion with the people who need it the most. Yeah? Because they're at the bar and these people really need things. So he serves them drinks. And he drinks, you know, he has to drink a little bit with them. And he also, he has to make up new drinks. So when he makes new drinks to sell to the customers, he has to taste them himself. But this is wonderful work because he's spreading the word of the Buddha in with these people who otherwise would never have contact with him. I'm serious. This is what he said in the email. Okay, so we do something like that. Don't we? Yeah. We you know, promise I'm not going to steal. But when there's something at work that we can get without paying for it, like using the, you know, maybe we have a certain expense account for meals, but we take our family out and bill it to the company. Yeah. So, you know, we have all these precepts, but we renegotiate them when it's convenient. Okay, so we have many teachers, but our ability to keep precepts remains weak. If we don't keep the precepts, are we practicing the teachings that our teachers gave us? No. And yet we keep going back to our teachers saying, please teach me this. And we keep on asking for the more and more and more advanced teachings. You know, we don't want teachings on Four Noble Truths. That's baby stuff. You know, talk about true cessation, true path, baby stuff. We are great practitioners. We should have teachings on Mahamudra and Dzogchen and highest yoga tantra, bliss and emptiness. Yeah. So we go back and, you know, we make our three prostrations. We confess, oh, I'm sorry, Rinpoche, I haven't kept my five lay precepts. You know, I've been having a relationship on the side, you know, in addition to my marriage. And I drank a little bit and a few little lies and, you know, yeah, had some seafood that I dropped in the hot water myself and stole some stuff, but it was just little Rinpoche. It was really not very bad, you know. But please, you know, teach me Dzogchen. We're great, aren't we? You know, I wonder how our teachers tolerate us sometimes. Yeah, I really wonder about it. One time I asked His Holiness a question, because I was working with him on this book, and I asked him a question, and he said, I've taught that many times before. Were you sleeping? Okay. I wasn't sleeping. I was distracted. Though I have many students, my patience and wish to help are scant. Shall we quickly make ourselves into big gurus? You know? It's what in India I used to call them the chai shop gurus. The chai shop, the tea shop. Because you go to one meditation course, then you go drink tea with all the other foreigners, and you've had one whole meditation course, so now you're the chai shop guru. And you can teach them all about meditation and Buddhism and this and that and the other thing. Okay? And so, you know, we make ourselves into teachers and have a lot of names. His Holiness always talks about people who in the Tibetan community, nobody knows who they are. They come to the West, and now they're, you know, His Eminence, Venerable Geshe Lama Kenpo Tulku Rinpoche. Yeah, who is teaching the most profound teaching that you definitely have to go to, or else you're going to be a loser. Okay, it's holy, you know. And it's true, we're full of those people here, aren't we? Yeah, chock-a-block full. Somebody sent me a book from Dorji Chong the second, or Dorji Chong the third, I forget which one he was. I don't know. Okay. So we have many students. Our patience and wish to help them are scant. Students can be such a nuisance. I mean, they're really nice when they bow to you and they sing your praises and they give you presents. Yeah? But otherwise, they are such a pain in the neck. They come and tell you all their problems. It's like, I have enough problems myself. What are you telling me your problems for? Yeah? And they want you to give teachings when you're exhausted. Yeah. You want to sit in a hot tub, and they want you to give teachings. You know, they have no patience. So students are really a pain in the neck. Who wants to help them? Yeah, my patience and wish to help are scant. But the donation basket is right there, and generosity is the cause of wealth, and you want to be wealthy in your next life, so there's the donation basket. Do you remember that skit we did at Life as a Western Buddhist Nun, where Dream Aid played the Rinpoche? Yes? Yeah? We were at a program in India 20 years ago now. Yeah, it was in 1996. And there was a Chinese nun who was teaching us Vinaya, and she wanted us to do skits. And so one of the Western nuns dressed up like a Rinpoche, and big, fat, you know, lots of glittering stuff, big hat with lots of glitter. Yeah, and so she was playing, you know, with all the students, the Western students who come. And, oh, Rinpoche, are you a real Rinpoche? Are you really a Buddha? Oh, goody, you know. And she was doing this, and she said, well, the donation basket is right there. You know? But it was really cute because there was somebody's daughter was in the audience, and the little girl didn't realize it was a skit. And she came up with an offering for our friend who was playing the Rinpoche. Okay, anyway, I just realized I've been talking a lot here. So the moral of the story is dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception, mortally strike at the heart of this butcher and enemy, the self. So we have to really learn about emptiness, meditate on emptiness, try and oppose our self-grasping ignorance, and do all the meditations on bodhicitta to develop bodhicitta and, you know, having equanimity for all sentient beings, impartial love and compassion for them, and cherishing them more than ourselves. So we have to really train our mind in these two things. And as a foundation, keep our precepts. Okay, maybe you have some questions. Yeah.
Spoke on Thursday, and I did speak with one person who was here Thursday,
mm-hmm.
who said that she felt the teaching was very difficult,
mm-hmm.
and didn't make her feel good. And of course, you know, it's not coming here to feel good,
yeah.
particularly, but to really comprehend the Dharma. So how can we work with that when the teachings are, say, more painful,
okay.
because of the circumstances that we're in, that our mind might be tight or it's challenging.
Okay, so our mind is tight. We hear the teachings and we feel like we're getting criticized, like the teachings are criticizing us, or that the teachings, the Buddha's asking us to do the impossible. It's just too difficult.
And the circumstances in life are such that hearing this are just...
Yeah, so our circumstances, like yeah, it's like rubbing, like sandpaper on a wound or salt in a wound. And what you really need is some talk about... what you really... Well, whatever you hear in the Dharma is going to point out our stuff, isn't it? Yeah, but what we would like is just maybe a meditation to imagine Chenrezig pouring light and, you know, experiencing Chenrezig's compassion. Maybe that's what we would like. And what we're hearing is, you know, here are your faults and you know. So I think if the circumstances of your life make it so that, you know, you can tell for yourself that you're really not receptive, then better maybe stay at home, do some meditation that makes you feel relaxed. Imagine Chenrezig, imagine the light coming from Chenrezig into you. Do something like that. Or, if you can, remind yourself that the Buddha is telling us these things out of compassion, and that there's no expectation that we become Buddha by next Tuesday. I think very often this kind of thing that, you know, this is just too hard, I can't take it in, it's asking more than I can give, is coming not so much because of the Buddha, because the Buddha says, look, you have endless lives, infinite lives, and the path is going to take a long time, but from our own expectation that we feel we should be able to be ideal practitioners very quickly. You know, and I think I find this very often in the West, that we have quite unreasonable expectations of ourselves, and we are quite harsh self-critics. We don't give ourselves a break. You know, we hear that it's three countless great eons of accumulating merit from the time we entered the path of accumulation. We haven't even entered that path yet. And we think, oh, you know, impossible. I'm just so lazy. How can I ever complete this path? It's just too much for me. I can't do it. You know, I'm just little old me. And so we self-sabotage before we even try. No, instead of saying, okay, I have the Buddha nature, I have the potential to become a fully awakened being. No. And nobody's asking me to do this quickly. The whole idea is that I take it in, I practice it in a way at a tempo that is comfortable for me, that I can do and keep a happy mind. So instead of saying that to ourselves, then we criticize ourselves. So in a way, we become our own worst enemy. Do you have ideas about that? What did you advise to that person?
I didn't really advise. I listened. Mm. But because I work in hospice too, a lot of people, especially those with long lingering illnesses, mm-hmm. are really challenged. And you know, one of my aspirations is how to have people be buoyant at end of life.
Yeah.
Or for caregivers, and a lot of us have to take care of our parents or people, and they just feel stuck, mm-hmm. especially when it lingers for years.
Yeah.
So, you know, the encouraging words help a lot.
Yeah.
But when it just seems like something endless, yeah. there's no light at the horizon.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
Yeah. That's hard, but that's also due to our incorrect way of thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like somebody tries to point out our incorrect way of thinking and we don't want to change. We're stuck. We don't want to change.
That's the hard part.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there's no light at the end of the tunnel. You know, I'm sure this situation is going to last forever. No situation is going to last forever, even if we want it to. It's impossible. Yeah? And so I think that, you know, rather than let ourselves get stuck in that kind of mental state, which is so easy to do, you know, and that's when you want to hire me to have your pity party for you. I think we need to have a sense of humor. You know, and this is what I found is so important in my Dharma practice, is the ability to laugh at myself and to laugh at how stupid I am and how stupid I think, you know, how stupid my thoughts are sometimes. You know, when you really look at what you think and compare it to the beauty of the Buddha's teachings, it's like you got to laugh because our mind is so ridiculous. Ridiculous. Yeah. I don't keep my precepts well, but I want to be my guru's favorite special student. It's like, that's hilarious, isn't it? Yeah, that's really funny. So, I mean, we have to laugh at ourselves in that way.
Hmm? But until you get that, it's not funny.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but you know, at some point you have to want to change. If you don't want to change, people can talk, they can do somersaults, they can do who knows what.
Yeah.
You're stuck. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I wanted to ask this question because I think you would have a good handle on it. It's a little... And I noticed this topic is becoming more popular in the English Buddhist literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how to make Buddhism in the U.S. more inclusive. Because it seems like we're kind of split. We have the ethnic groups,
mm-hmm.
which are kind of like cultural institutions as well, mm-hmm. help people connect to their countries of origin and transmit that to their children.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the non-ethnic Buddhism, which are like convert.
Yeah, convert Buddhism.
Groups. And that's great, you know, everyone's a, you know, it doesn't have the cultural background, but it tends to appeal to just a certain group
mm-hmm.
of people, not really a wide range yeah. of people either. So, what's,
yeah.
what's your
opinion? Okay.
Having been worked with the Vietnamese youth group, you know, some Buddhist groups have very few youth.
Yeah.
Too. So, what's your.
Okay, so my thought about ethnic Buddhism and convert Buddhism.
Make it more inclusive for the next generation.
Yeah, yeah. How to make. Yeah, do you have.
Well, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, okay. Oh. It's how to make Buddhism more inclusive for the next generation. Yeah, because, that he's saying that there are ethnic temples that transmit the culture, then there are convert Buddhism, but most of those are people who are older. Yeah, so how do you reach out to the youth? Yeah. I think you have to do this. Which, unfortunately, many of us dinosaurs are not so good at. Yeah, those of us my age were dinosaurs. Yeah, so I think there's a few factors here. I think one is to be able to talk about the Dharma in a way that relates to the minds of the young people. Yeah, so that it... You're talking about things that are interesting to them. You're not just sitting and taking out a sutra and giving a line-by-line, you know, etymology of everything. You're talking about what does it mean to have friends? Okay. How do you get along with your parents? How does practicing Dharma help you get along with your parents? What's the meaning of your life? Yeah. What does it mean to love somebody? So I think you have to talk about the things that young people are thinking about and relating to and bring the Dharma to in that way. At least that's been my experience. Okay? But without compromising the Dharma. Some people say, well, we should just have a disco party and invite all the young people to the Dharma Center and then they'll come back for teachings later. That's not my style. Okay, I don't feel the need to, you know, have a disco thing so that the young people become interested. We have a course every summer, usually in June, for young adults age... Well, this year we had... The youngest was 17, the oldest was 31. Usually we say 18 to 29, but we had people on both ends. And these are very special young people who come because they're really questioning and they want to know. And it's a beautiful course because we have discussion groups where we talk about things that are really of interest to them and where they learn how to talk with each other and bring in Dharma perspective. And so it isn't 50 young people. It's maybe 10, but boy, they're getting it. And slowly, you know, they will go home and they will tell their friends about things.
I just wanted to share that his experience was so refreshing to the home. It was every day I only learn more about how Dharma can affect the quality of our family life, how we can look at treating one another, how we present. Even though we've been open to meditation since he was a child, what he came home with that summer was a practical approach.
Mm.
And so even though the big concepts of karma and reincarnation and transmigration and enlightenment are all there, but it's the day-to-day, how to implement conversation, how to look at one another, how to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
We are thankful so much. So I come today with my appreciation for how you've touched my son's life and how he's, you know, who's the parent, who's the child, who's the guru, who's the disciple. It gets mixed up a bit.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I am.
Good.
He had to work, so I apologize he couldn't join.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. He was a delight to have at the Abbey. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a question, please, Venerable. I've heard a practitioner say that they've taken refuge with a person, meaning I'm assuming a senior Dharma teacher or something, but I'm not sure what that means.
Means, okay. Yes. Actually, what it means, or what it should mean, is that that was the person who you did the refuge ceremony with. But you took refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Some people don't understand that, and they think they're taking refuge in the person. They're taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the teacher is the one who's leading the ceremony that helps them make that connection to the three jewels.
But in this case, from what I understood, this was a multiple person that they've done it with. So I wasn't understanding.
What do you mean, a multiple person?
Well, that they had already taken refuge with someone, and this was another person that they. So okay. Was it that they had selected another teacher, or they were recognizing another teacher in their life?
Yeah.
Or
it could be. It's hard for me to know. You're thinking about a specific situation. I haven't talked to that person, so I can't say for sure. It could be, because we can have more than one teacher, so maybe that person was adding a teacher, okay? I don't know. I don't know the person. You should better to ask them. Or sometimes people want to renew their refuge. They did the ceremony once, but when you do the ceremony, sometimes you take precepts, and people want to renew their precepts, so they do the ceremony again. But it's very important that people understand your refuge is in the three jewels. Yeah? And that's across the board for all the Buddhist traditions.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have a question, and this is before I started on the path to Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had this, I was telling her earlier that it's like my little voices. I was raised in the Christian religion until I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't, I knew there was something else. But for all these years until now, I'm going to be 67, I finally woke up. But I always had these little voices. I said, if you don't pay attention to these little voices or your feelings, you know, mm-hmm. inside, that they'll tell you, you know, don't do this, you'll get, like, don't stick your hand in the fire, you'll get burned type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, would that be like deities or something following me, guiding me?
No, I think that's maybe just your own wisdom coming out.
Is that from previous lives?
It could be. It's hard. Again, it's hard for me to say.
Okay.
I don't know, really. It could be, you know, you have some habits of acting virtuously in previous lives, and then you're remembering them now? It could be.
I have a personal question, and I hope it's not offensive, but I also think maybe it's a hoarding thought that I have that keeps coming back. So my understanding is the Federation of the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition is vegetarian.
And that is the what?
Vegetarian diet.
Uh-huh.
Not to have, not to hurt any animals.
Mm-hmm.
And eat vegetarian diet.
Mm-hmm.
And then my stuck point is now I've been a vegetarian, of course, that's no problem. Since I was a child, I heard about what happens to the animals. Done.
Mm-hmm.
But then I heard about the dairy industry in America, so I researched it. And now I'm a little bit concerned because even when we had crickets in the house, the whole mm-hmm. family tried to capture the crickets and take them out. Mm-hmm. And then I found out about the dairy industry being so cruel to
To the cows,
their offspring, and they're no different than the meat industry.
Yeah.
And so when I talk to my vegetarian friends, I'm stuck because mm-hmm. they want Parmesan, their cheese. And now I feel like I'm becoming an activist.
Okay, so the question is, it starts out first, with you become a vegetarian, but your friends are eating meat, and you can't understand why they keep eating meat. And then you learn about the dairy industry and you decide you want to stop having dairy, but now your vegetarian friends still want dairy. Yeah. I think, it's people do what they're capable of doing. We're all doing what we're capable of doing. And so I think it's good to rejoice at what people are capable of doing. Maybe they're still having cheese. I eat cheese, but I'm a vegetarian. So you rejoice at what they're doing that is beneficial, and just realize that, people are doing what they can do. And being a born again vegetarian or a born again vegan.
Yeah.
Doesn't help.
It doesn't help because it rankles my mind.
And it rankles them, too.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit becoming an activist. And that side is new. So the word rejoice is a beautiful word.
Yeah.
And it lifts the whole dialogue in a different place. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that because I want to be free from that.
Yes.
I really do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a hoarding of a thought.
Yeah. So to rejoice at what people are capable of doing.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Yeah.
I was thinking of maybe you can speak just a little bit about Shravasi and your projects.
Oh. Okay. So to talk about Shravasti Abbey. So it's an abbey. We called it an abbey because it can have monks and nuns and also lay people. It's in eastern Washington state on about 300 acres of forest and meadow, beautiful land. And we started in 2003. The original residents were me and two cats. And now we have a community of 15. Three of them are trainees, and one is entering the community. We have courses and retreats and different things that are open to the public, so people come up and join the courses and things we do. Some people come and just want to spend a few weeks living with us or a few months living with us, or just the afternoon and offer service because we depend a lot on volunteers. So many people come for that. And when they come, then they just participate in our daily schedule, which includes meditation, periods of offering service. That's what other people call work, but we call it offering service because it changes your mind when you offer service. And then we have teachings on it, you know. And so people are welcome to come and spend time with us. And it's a very wonderful community. I'm quite happy there. It's maybe the only Tibetan training monastery for Westerners in the States. Yeah, there aren't a lot of places like that. So, okay, so you're all welcome to come and visit. And we have lots of material online because we put, we video all the teachings there online. And then almost every day we have a short talk before lunch. It's called Bodhisattva Breakfast Corner because it started out being at breakfast, but we moved it to lunch. But we still have the same title. But it's a short talk, a Dharma talk, and those are on the web. You know, then the website has written material, all sorts of stuff. So, and everything is offered free. We don't charge for anything.
You know, what's nice is that where I live, there's no Dharma centers whatsoever.
Mm.
And so you are my Dharma center through the YouTube.
Yeah.
That's exactly great, you know, because whenever you have questions about particular topics or anything, you can just Google
dipandchodron.com
or Travosti Abbey and just get an incredible amount of resources and clarity on your questions. So I think I'll take this as a segue to thank you so much for coming.
Thank
and
you.
Your teachings.
Okay.
And again, we're I think we're out of books except for one.
Oh, no, there's
more
one.
Left.
Here.
There's just one more left.
Okay, you got it.
And have it autographed by Chodron.
Yeah.
And there's a sign up list if you want to be on the mailing list. And also, you can make your offerings. And there are mugs there. Two of the Abbey cars just conked out in the last 10 days. So these mugs are fundraisers to help the monastery get into SUV, hopefully.
I'm just going to chant a dedication verse so we can dedicate all the merit that we created as individuals and as a group. Share the goodness we created with all the living beings in the universe. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore.